This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Resolute Square.
There was also maintained what was called an enemies list, which was rather extensive and continually being updated.
Democrats want Republicans dead.
Where I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and I wouldn't lose any voters, okay?
The women with the least likelihood of getting pregnant are the ones most worried about having abortions.
On January 6th of 2021, you had tens of thousands of people peacefully protesting.
No, it's not a right-wing conspiracy theory. It's not QAnon. It's real.
I'm Rick Wilson, and this is The Enemies List.
Our guest today on The Enemies List is former Congressman Adam Kinzinger. You've seen Adam on the January 6th hearings. You've seen him talking about his role as an apostate Republican. And I hope that you'll join me today in having a great conversation with him about his new book, Renegade, Defending Democracy and Liberty in Our Divided Country. It's an important book, and Adam's an important figure in a moment that we're in right now because he is one of the few Republicans who actually walked the walk, who actually said he stood for a set of beliefs. And when it came down to, you know, either bending the knee or sticking by those beliefs, he chose to stick by them. He is now a former congressman. We're going to talk a lot about where he's at right now. But Adam, thank you so much for coming on The Enemies List today. Give us a little bit of a rundown on how you went from being a Republican congressman to being a renegade, to being an apostate, to leaving the party's, you know, warm embrace and rejecting the unconstitutional Trumpism and the dangers that it posed.
The very top line version, the very kind of quick and dirty version is I have a moral red line that I'm unable to cross. You know, in politics, you have to compromise. I mean, there's always compromise. Anybody that pretends like there's no compromise is just not telling the truth. But in my case, it just got to a point where it was too much. And, you know, I understand how dangerous it is for democracies when you destroy trust in an election system. It's not just dangerous. A democracy can't survive if people don't even trust the basic election system. And, you know, and I understood what the ego of Donald Trump was doing to people's brains, these brain worms they were getting and the danger to the country. And I just couldn't, like, having fought for the country in the military, I'm like, I can't, like, be willing to ask people to put their lives on the line for America. And then I'm not willing to put, like, a job on the line for America. So that was the bottom line of it. Just a red line I couldn't cross. And eventually my moral center took over.
You know, while you were in Congress, you represented a more moderate district than a lot of your Tea Party style brethren. But, you know, in reading the book, I noticed you sort of had some of the same feelings I had, like maybe the Tea Party's peaked in 2012. Maybe it's going to fade down. Maybe the craziness is going to go, you know, is it be less prevalent. And, you know, people like our mutual friend, John Boehner, you know, were center-right Republicans. They were not, he was not an insane person, but it didn't ever go down, did it? It never quite settled back to what we claimed were our ideological principles. Instead, it got more crazy.
Yeah, it never did. My district, and it was crazy because my district did start sort of moderate, and by the time I was out, it was basically almost as crazy, at least in the party, as really any district. But yeah, I mean, you know, what was it? What was that election? Was it like 14 or 2014, where we actually the establishment struck back?
Yes,
we're like, oh, we're gonna win. You know, we're gonna be we did this. We beat the witch and wherever the hell she was and
Delaware.
Delaware. And you know, and so there was some good feelings. And look, I think, I mean, looking back, we probably would have lost anyway. But certainly, then Donald Trump came along and he tapped into that, like, what I thought was a dying part of the party, and he put fuel on it. It's like when you have the embers of a fire, you know, it's out, and then somebody dumps a gallon of gasoline on it. And I feel like that's what happened. He just came along and, yes, he was, you know, people ask you all the time, they ask me, is he the cause or is he a symptom? It's kind of both, but he certainly accelerated that loss there.
Yeah, I think that moment of 2014 where McConnell and a lot of the folks in the House really went out and tried to reduce the crazy and to not have people who were automatically disqualified from gaining office because they were so insane. That moment, I mean, that was like the false dawn, the calm before the storm, because you know, right after that, every lesson was forgotten. And basically the system now is to select the craziest, the most loyal to Trump, the most edge case weirdos that they can get. And so people like us have no real role in a party like that because, you know, they burn the establishment to the ground. I mean, and you saw that when you were still in Congress as, and not just January 6th, I want to get to that in a minute, but when Trump was in office, you saw the caucus shifting into a much different, like post-ideological and just Trump-driven body. What was it like in that 16 to 20 window as you saw everything sort of burning to the ground?
You know, you don't get PTSD while you're in war. When you're in war, you're operating. And it's when you get home and the guns are silent that you can kind of like look back and say, okay, this is what happened, or you realize the impact it took. So for me, now that I can look back at those years of like 16 to 20, I'm just like, it was really depressing. And it was, for me, less depressing that, you know, Donald Trump was president. That was depressing. So I'm not minimizing that. But the thing that really hit me was all these people that I had worked with for, I guess by that time, about 5 years in 2016, that I thought all had a moral red line, that they all would, you know, they believed in something. And to watch them tick away and pass that moral center and justify it, that was really depressing for me as I look back on it. Because all of a sudden, you know, from 16 on, I really felt isolated in the party. And, you know, we live in a society now where your political identity is a huge part of your identity. So I started to feel kind of homeless at that point. I think, yeah, I mean, watching people sell their soul is more depressing than even seeing who they sell their soul to.
Yeah, I think that's really a good observation, because there were so many people that you and I both knew who were these stalwarts. They were like, I am a constitutionalist. I believe in the rule of law. And then it was sort of like, no matter what Trump did, it was like, okay, cool. And it just didn't, it never seemed to fit with all of their, you know, supposedly inviolate ideological principles and everything else. But yeah, they won by one. And by the end, it was pretty much down to you and Liz Cheney. I mean, by the time 20 hit, the Great Coward Caucus had increased so much that it was, you were the last two holding the line. In the course of all the madness. I do want to talk a little bit about January 6th, because that was a really catalyzing day for you and for the country. And I want to talk about what your experience was on that day, and then your experience about trying to hold Trump to account on the January 6th committee.
Support for Rick Wilson's The Enemies List comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable, all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/Wilson. That's odoo.com/Wilson. Odoo, modern management made simple.
Well, look, the experience of that day, I had actually predicted violence. So on the first, I was on a phone call, and it was with the whole Republican conference. And at that point, Kevin McCarthy had not been saying how he was going to vote on certification. And I guess my assumption was he would vote to certify the election because, as you know, like, leadership in the party is supposed to take the tough votes. You know, that's their job. And unfortunately, voting to certify was the tough vote at that moment. So Liz Cheney gives some really compelling case about voting to certify. And then McCarthy says something like, Liz doesn't speak for the whole conference. And then he went on to talk about how he was going to, you know, vote against certification. And I was the first person to talk after him. And I just said, Kevin, I said, you are convincing half of the country that an election was stolen. You and I both know how folks talk, where it's like, yeah, we were founded on revolution as a country. We're proud of that. We should be proud of that. And if you're convinced that an election was stolen, you should be rioting. I mean, honestly, you should be. And because that's what, and I'm like, we are convincing people through a lie. And he just said something like, okay, Adam, next caller. So on the 6th, I went and I actually was armed. I usually didn't take my gun to the Capitol. I never took my gun to the Capitol because we could, but there were so many police but I did that day, and my wife stayed home. My staff stayed home, and I went on the floor for the start of the proceedings. Ended up leaving because I was sensing something was off. And by the time I got back to the office, that's when the stuff was really hitting the fan. And DC Metro had just shown up. I remember opening the window to my office, which overlooked the west front of the Capitol, and I just heard bang, pop, boom. And I got to tell you, here's the weird thing about that, Rick, is. So as a Christian, like, I'm not one of these that walk around like feel or sense evil. I never have in my life, except on January 6th, there was like a darkness that I have never felt before. And I've never felt since, just like a darkness. And, you know, and then I basically hunkered down. I took my pistol out, wow. Had it on my desk. It was about 30 minutes where I was entertaining the real possibility that I might have to shoot somebody. And that, you know, the rest of the day is history. I remember going on the floor to give my speech, though, and I basically unloaded on Trump and, you know, and the party, and said the emperor has no clothes. And when I was done, I turned around and every Republican behind me just kind of has their head in their lap, just, you know, embarrassed, ashamed, but they weren't going to change. And I just, that was the beginning. And then Kevin McCarthy going to Mar-a-Lago obviously was the big thing. But I'm just like, oof.
Yeah, even Kevin on the floor that day was pretty stern on Trump. And yet a few days later, down to kiss the ring one more time. So you saw it firsthand, you experienced it firsthand, you understood the stakes. And so we end up with an attempted impeachment of Trump. We end up with the January 6th hearings. And essentially, it was adversarial with the entire Republican Party, essentially, except for you and Liz Cheney. Tell us about the experience of watching the information that you had on from the committee sort of unfold over time, and how that showed you more about, you know, how deep the rabbit hole went with Trump basically being the motive force behind all of this stuff.
So, you know, I actually went into this committee thinking we would fail, just because what congressional committee actually succeeds, right? I mean, none. And I'm like, I have to make an effort. This is like one of those like life defining decisions. And so, but as we got in, the most valuable player on the committee, interestingly, was Mark Meadows. He had provided like a tranche of text messages, and then he quit cooperating. But through those texts, we were able to like kind of map out these connections. And which, by the way, quick aside, he's cooperating now. I think Trump's goose is cooked. I think when all of what he knows comes out, Trump is cooked. I mean, that's my hope. You and I have predicted this.
Yeah, right. Year, so who knows? It's like Christmas.
Yeah, it is. It is. So, but what really was eye-opening to me is I kind of went into this wondering, was Trump kind of hapless victim that rode a wave to January 6th, or did he intend it? And as we started to see the meeting with the DOJ, for instance, where he said, just say it's corrupt and then leave the rest to me and the Republican congressman. And you started to see how he proactively resisted, first time in his life, he resisted peer pressure to act during the insurrection. I realized like he was behind this. And that's as that unfolded, and you kind of, my eyes were opened as to how much he knew, how much he directed, how much he was told. That's when I became extremely passionate. You know, I thought he was responsible, obviously, from the beginning. But that's when I became extremely passionate that this guy uniquely brought people together to overthrow an election. And now with Dan Scavino, and you saw the leaked testimony where it's like Dan Scavino was saying, we're just not going to leave. We never got to talk to him. I thought our information on the committee was so compelling. And now the DOJ is going to have way more. And I'll say quickly, the DOJ would not be doing what they're doing without the January 6th committee hearing. And I know that for a fact.
Oh, no, absolutely not. You guys did all the lifting and the legwork to put together an awful lot of this. And I think that, you know, the DOJ has been moving at its usual sort of methodical or glacial, depending on who you ask, pace. And I think there's a moment that I know for myself, and I know a lot of other people, I think, there was a frustration like, okay, they're putting the small fry in jail. The assholes with the bear spray are going to prison. But what about Meadows? What about Trump? What about the people at the top? And it does feel increasingly like they're closing in on some of the people who were closer to the top of the food chain rather than just the small fry at this point.
Yeah, it does. And it feels like, you know, either they're getting these folks to cooperate to save their butts, or they're going to go after them, of course, with the ultimate goal being Donald Trump. And, you know, look, we never want to be a country that goes after the last administration, but we never want to be a country that lets the last administration get away with what happened. Or the incentive is basically, if you're president, you can try a coup, because as long as you fail, you're fine. And if you succeed, you're in charge. So why not? And so, yeah, it's going to be interesting to watch this. And I'm still optimistic to the point that I still believe in 10 years, you're not going to find a single person in the country to admit that they were ever a Trump supporter. That's what I still believe. Because his, like, the emotion of him will wear off. He's going to die at some point, right? So his daily, whatever, reinforcement of assholery is going to go away. And I just think these things come in cycles. So when he is put on the stand and that case is put out there, I'm hoping, look, I wouldn't bet all my money on it for sure, but I'm hoping that's a moment when everybody's kind of like, oh man. I use the analogy of, like, I feel like we're in a Friday night bender and everybody's just beyond drunk. And it's like, we need to wake up Saturday morning, like, see the chickens in the room and, like, the strewn clothing and just be like, what in the world did we do? Like, what did we do last night?
There's a tiger in the bathroom.
Yeah, exactly. That's the moment we have to hit. I feel like, though, we've hit it and, you know, we just start drinking bloodies on a Saturday or something.
I think you're right. At some point, the love of Trump will transform into shame for some people. There'll be some dead enders till the very last. But once he goes, I mean, once he shuffles off this mortal coil, it's going to be a lot harder for Don Jr. or one of the other morons to sustain that level of, like, cult-like hyper devotion that his people have expressed over and over again.
Well, and I think there is shame now. I think part of the reason that people double down so much and they go into their little echo chamber silos and they have their, like, cult friendships is because what they did was so shameful that you cannot expose yourself to anything but that reaffirmation that what you're doing is fighting a jihad, fighting a holy war. Why is it that Kevin McCarthy shoulder checked me twice on the floor? And why is it that he elbowed, you know, Burchett from Tennessee? Because he's projecting, because he feels shame as well.
I wanted to talk about Kevin for a minute, because people were convinced that it couldn't get much worse than Kevin McCarthy. Where do you think Kevin's brain is right now? Because I sort of feel like this is a guy who's still has not processed the mental, like the complete humiliation he's experienced enough yet. I feel like he hasn't quite, like, it doesn't seem real to him yet. I couldn't show up in public if I'd been that humiliated.
Yeah. And I think part of it is because it's so great. It's such great humiliation. I mean, it's like a divorce. You know, if you go through a divorce, it's like everything you kind of built for falling apart is just like, whoa, this is him, because his whole thing in life was to be a powerful person. And it ended up, like, the most powerful thing he could achieve personally as a California rep was Speaker of the House. And he made it. And that was everything. That's, Rick, why he made the decision. He didn't love Donald Trump. He made the decision to double down on Trump because he knew he couldn't defeat him in time for the speaker's race. So he had to embrace him. And I think it hasn't fully sunk in. It's kind of like, again, it's that moment of, like, warfare. It's when you get home and you're sitting in the silence. You know, it's like the beginning of Apocalypse Now, where you're staring at the ceiling fan. It's like those moments where that pressure falls on you. And what he's done by staying in the House is allowed himself to stay engaged and put salve on his, like, ego wound. But someday it's going to come tumbling down. And I honestly, I want him to find help. I pray for him because I want him to not collapse, but I think he's going to collapse into a heap of something.
I mean, the guy I knew 20 years ago the number of compromises he made to get where he had to be or wanted to be, he had to know they were going to cash the check someday. And that if you give people like Matt Gaetz and Andy Biggs and Paul Gosar and all the crazies, if you give them a gun and put it to your head, they're going to someday pull the trigger. You should pray you never want anything as much as he wanted to be speaker, because it makes you crazy like that.
Well, and the guy you and I knew was the guy that said, hey, I'm going to, you know, turn tech into Republicans because we're going to have this new 21st century agenda. He said, we're going to put Republicans on the front page of climate change. And then he just collapsed into a heap of Donald Trumpism. And now, again, I mean, I think part of the reason I've heard that he's stayed in the House is because the job offers that he thought would come pouring in after his speakership aren't coming in. People that were tied to Donald Trump don't find jobs.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm sure Jeff Miller told him every day, don't worry, you're coming out of here and you're going to be on six corporate boards and all that. And now the guy can't get a reservation at a Waffle House at this point.
That's right.
You know, so tell us what you're up to now. You're doing the book right now, right? You're out on the book tour circuit.
Yeah, that's coming to an end. That's ending here in a couple of days. I mean, I'll do some one-offs, but it's been a pretty busy month. So doing some speaking, doing the book tour. Book's done really well. It made the New York Times bestseller, which, like, as the only book I'm ever going to write, God please, in my life, like, that's a good thing to do. And then, you know, I'm working for CNN. I'm a senior political commentator. And then I'm going to figure out what's next. You know, it's been a very nice year, you know, been able to make some money and kind of spend a lot of time with family, but that's not the long-term thing. I mean, I would have told you 10 months ago, there's not a prayer I would ever get back into politics. I have this organization, Country First. It's country, the number one, ST.com. That's been fun, but the itch is coming back a little. So I'd never want to run for the House again. I don't know if I'm a Republican or a Democrat or what I am anymore, but I do know that if, you know, I'm not going to rule out running again, or at least helping good people to run either way.
I think that's right. And look, you have a gift for public service. You've shown it both in the House and in your military service, and don't foreclose it just because the current crop of people you'd be dealing with are assholes. And it is a bountiful crop of assholes. I grant you.
It is.
I grant you. So you're doing some flying. You got a new plane. You got a new rig.
I did. Yep. So I'm retiring from the Air Force, which makes me sad, but you know, 22 years goes by really fast. But I bought for anybody that knows planes, it's a Merlin 300. There's not many of them in the country, but
they're fast. Ooh, that's a go fast plane right there.
Oh, it's really fast. It's 300 knots. But I'll tell you, Rick, I actually was flying the other day, and for the first time in what, 28, I don't know, 20 some years of flying, I lost an engine. I had an engine.
Holy crap.
Never had it happen. Thankfully, it happened in a two-engine plane and not the one engines I used to own. And I was close enough to the airport. I just was able to turn around and land. We practiced for that. But that was definitely, we call that sucking up seat cushion moment.
I had a engine out in the right seat of a Baron one time, and I wasn't even flying the plane. I was like, I don't like this. This is not the CFI sneaking over and pulling down the. I was like, no, yeah, thank
exactly.
you.
Exactly. It's a little frightening. Yeah,
but anyway, well, listen, Adam, I really appreciate you coming on the Enemies List today. Folks, the book is Renegade, Defending Democracy and Liberty in Our Divided Country. It's a terrific, terrific insight into Adam's journey, you know, from his military service to his service in Congress in a really tumultuous and important time. I encourage you to get it. Adam, where can people find you on social media?
On Twitter, it's Adam Kinzinger. You can find it. I'm the one with almost 1 million followers and a lot of snarky stuff. I got to lay off Twitter some. And then Adam_Kinzinger on Instagram and Threads. I'm trying to spin up Threads. And lastly, I have a Substack now. Adam Kinzinger at Substack.
All right. Well, thank you, Adam. We really appreciate you coming on today. And look forward to talking to you again soon.
You bet. Great chatting with you.
Well, folks, today on the Enemies List is Katara Revanche, also known as George Santos, also known as the soon-to-be ex-congressman from New York. Look, Santos, the sort of Anna Delvey of American politics, was always a fraud and always a liar. But now the House Ethics Committee has absolutely unloaded on this mook. And it's been discovered that his entire campaign was a complex financial fraud. He was misrepresenting the nature of the donations being given to him and that he was and the spending he was making. It is absolutely a shocking report of flagrant corruption. And of course, we found out that he spent a lot of his campaign money on Botox, Hermes, and OnlyFans, which does sound like a great rock band, but is in fact a sign that this guy is a criminal. The House should expel him immediately. George Santos, you are on the enemies list and will remain so.
Thanks again for listening to the enemies list. If you have any comments, questions, or if there's someone you'd like to hear on the podcast, hit me up on Twitter at TheRickWilson. Thanks again for the wonderful support you've shown the pod. We're growing fast. It really helps if you will share this with your friends, your family, and anyone else who, like us, is trying to save democracy. While you're at it, if you could rate and review the podcast, I would be very much appreciative. I know this is the sort of thing you've heard a billion times. Please rate, review, like, blah, blah, blah. But you need to do it. It really does help us a lot. We are slaves to the algorithm, my friends. And if you do this, it will help get the pod out further. Anyway, thanks again for listening. I'll see you next time. And remember, whatever you do, stay off the list.